99-2810-W, 99-3110-W, State of Wisconsin, X Rel, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries America, Inc., versus Circuit Court of Milwaukee County et al. And we had originally scheduled 20, 20, and 20, but somebody is not using their time, right? And you can explain that to us. 20 minutes for Mr. Weber representing Mitsubishi Heavy Industries America. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. Ralph Weber and Colleen Ball here for Mitsubishi Heavy Industries America, Inc. Your Honors, hard cases make bad law, and we're here against the backdrop of intense public curiosity in a major public works project and accident in Milwaukee, known as the Miller Park litigation. Against that backdrop of intense public curiosity, trial judge Dominic Amato created a new right of public access to civil discovery in the hands of private parties. In creating this new right, Judge Amato made several mistakes. First, he misread history. Second, he ignored U.S. Supreme Court statements. And third, he gave no thought to the consequences of this new right of access that he was creating. In looking at our respective briefs, it occurred to me that the parties really had not joined issue, that there was a gulf between the parties. And one way to bridge that gap might be to look at this in the context of 80309. Because after all, Journal Sentinel came to the trial court and said, we have a right, pursuant to 80309, to intervene. And in order to have a right, it's not enough that you have an interest, that you have a curiosity, that you have a concern. You must have a protectable legal interest. You must claim an interest relating to the property or transaction which is the subject of the action, and disposition of the action may impair or impede the movement's ability to protect that interest unless the movement's interest is adequately represented by existing parties. So this court has addressed the protectable legal interest question several times in recent years in Builder and in Edson and in Armada. And in those cases, the court said the burden is on the intervener. So the burden is on Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to say, what is your protectable legal interest? They've conceded that they have no rights that are greater than that of the general public. So it's as if Doug Smith came off the street and said to Judge Amato, you know, I'd like to have access to these depositions because Journal Sentinel, the media, has no greater right of access than the public, as they have conceded. And so in Builder and Edson, they could look to the specific public record statute and say, okay, there's your protectable legal interest and we'll allow you to intervene. And in Armada, they could say, if you could go through a list of statutes and common law that said, yes, here are the rights that you are entitled to protect. Here's your protectable legal interest, not just your curiosity, not just your concern. So we have to turn then to the basis for Judge Amato's decision. And in looking that, again, keep in mind the distinction between access to information and dissemination of information. Dissemination of information is what Seattle Times involved, because there, the newspaper had gotten access by virtue of being a party in the lawsuit, the defamation claim. And in Seattle Times, the newspaper conceded that if they were just there trying to get access, that they wouldn't be entitled to it.
Also, excuse me for interrupting, but it strikes me that the heart of the argument and at the heart of Judge Amato's decision, one which did not have a great deal of, at least he didn't articulate a great deal of support, was the predicate or the assumption that these were public records. Is that what you're getting at here, that these
yes.
are not? Okay.
That's
I'm
right.
sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's right. Because, first of all, we look at the statutes, public records statute, and it's not in there. And then let's look at the history. How has The common law and procedural rules treated deposition transcripts for centuries. And there's excellent reviews of the history of this area in Judge Scalia's opinion in the Reporters Committee case, 773 F. 2nd, 1337, and Times versus McDonnell Douglas, District Court opinion out of California, 387 F. Sup. 195. They go through the history that I'm about to touch on briefly. And that is that going back to the Judiciary Act of 1789, depositions were not available. Depositions were sealed. They were not available to the public. And that principle was continued on in Supreme Court cases in 1814 and in 1912. And the same rule was followed in this state going back to 1878 when we said depositions are sealed. They're not open to the public. And even under the current rules, where depositions are not retained in court, they are to be sealed by the court reporter. And
where does the court get the authority to say seal or not? I mean, if these depositions were never filed in court, right?
Right.
Taken by the parties.
Right.
So how does the court have any authority over them?
Over the parties and the transcripts?
Over the transcripts, yes.
I don't think the court does. They're in the hands of private litigants. The statute addresses what is to be done with the transcripts upon preparing them by the court reporter.
The court does have power over it. In the Seattle Times case, the court said you can't disseminate them. So the court has power over this. The court can order them in, can't it?
Could order the parties to file, yes. Pursuant to their power over the litigants.
So that the court has some power over these documents.
Through their power over the litigants, sure.
Well, what would you do, counsel, in another lawsuit, not this one, your opponent's attorney decided on his or her own to simply give to the press depositions? How would you control that?
Right. That brings up that distinction between access and dissemination. The party gets access to the transcripts by being the party in the case. If that party then elects to disseminate them, I would need to go into court and seek a protective order asking the court not to allow the party to disseminate them.
The Chief Justice asked a question on the Seattle Times. That's, in my opinion, or at least looking at it, that's a little different case in the sense that the press or the newspaper was already a litigant and a party, and here we have the press being an intervener coming in. Does that make a difference?
Yes, it does. Again, it goes back to the access versus dissemination point. And I've read the oral arguments of the Supreme Court debate in Seattle Times, and there the newspaper was asked, well, if you weren't a litigant, would you have right to this private financial information? And they said, no, we don't. We understand that's an access issue, and the cases go against us on access. So, yes, in Seattle Times, they had access only by virtue of their standing as a party. And then as a party, the court exercised its power to regulate dissemination. And in Seattle Times, remember, the court went back and quoted with approval Justice Berger's concurrence in Gannett, which was, it has never occurred to anyone, so far as I am aware, that a pretrial deposition or pretrial interrogatories were other than wholly private to the parties. In Seattle Times, the court went on to say, pretrial depositions are not public components of actual trials. Such proceedings were not open to the public at common law. And in general, they are conducted in private as a matter of modern practice. So there is no statutory right, there is no common law right that a third-party intervener like the Journal Sentinel or Doug Smith off the street can point to and say, I have this protectable legal interest.
But counsel, we have said, in fact I wrote it, that the press serves as the eyes and the ears of the public. And here you've got a major project that is being paid for by the taxpayers, some of them not too willingly. If I can read everything I read in the newspaper, believe everything I read in the newspaper, with a vast public interest in this. Now, why is that, I shouldn't have used those words, why is that not a sufficient public interest to justify the request?
Well, because it becomes circular. If it is a case about which a lot of people have a concern or a curiosity, such that they come to court, Doug Smith says, here I am, I'm curious about this case for whatever reason. My neighbor's involved in a lawsuit, and I'd like to see his private financial records. I'm curious, I have an interest. Therefore, you have to let me in under 80309.
But it strikes me that saying that they're curious you're saying that in a dismissive way, but of course, curiosity can be extremely legitimate, too.
Of course.
What if this was a lawsuit involving, say, public corruption, and there were depositions being taken of witnesses to the corruption? Are you saying that the press could not get a hold of those?
Well, it depends. Again, if it's at the same point, and again, that's not this case, no, I don't think so. Because another aspect of intervention is that the move-in's interest may be adequately represented by existing parties. And again, we have a private, it involves, of course, a matter of great public concern. But what this lawsuit is a wrongful death suit, a private lawsuit between three estates, three families, and a number of defendants. And while it is against the backdrop of this public project, it isn't a public inquiry. There are separate bodies. OSHA is investigating this accident. The Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office is investigating this accident.
Yeah, but that really is in another area where you have these, as I understand it, five employees or five, there's a gag order out on that at least exists for 30 days. So what I think that's different there than what we're talking about or just establishing this question.
Right. What I'm saying is while it is against the backdrop of public interest, this is not a public lawsuit. It's not Jim Doyle as the litigant, it's not OSHA, it's not the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office. It is, at its base, a private lawsuit between individuals and defendants seeking monetary damages for three deaths.
Mr. Weber, let me follow up, if I might, on Justice Wilcox's question. The depositions of the Mitsubishi employees, those still have not been released?
No, that's right. By its term, I'm sorry.
When are they scheduled to be released, if ever?
30 days after the last Mitsubishi witness is deposed, and he has not yet been deposed. There were five people identified.
Okay, and there's mention of redaction taking place. What was to be redacted in regard to depositions?
There is a standard protective order that was signed by Judge Amato early on after he came to the case that covers things like trade secrets, design drawings, and those sorts of things.
So that's a separate order from the so-called gag order.
Yes, it is.
And let me ask one more question, if I might. Partial intervention. My understanding is that when Judge Amato, granted the motion, in some way he thought he was granting partial intervention by the newspaper. Have you ever heard of that idea or that term, partial intervention?
No, it really wasn't clear to me what he was doing, because he jumped over the intervention point and said, because these used to be filed with the court, they're public records, and therefore you have this right. And then once he said that, said, therefore your motion to intervene is moot. And I don't really understand what he was doing. When the Journal Sentinel subsequently submitted their order, they tried to address that point by saying there was a limited intervention for purposes of asserting this right of access.
Is that basically the form of the order he then signed, indicating
right.
in some way that the intervention was being allowed, but it was only for that purpose?
I believe that's how it came out. We can pull the order. My sense of it was that the judge wanted to make clear that although he was letting Journal Sentinel in, they weren't going to be a party on the same level as Mitsubishi and Lance.
Counsel, is there a difference in the right of access to criminal proceedings as opposed to civil proceedings? And if so, what's the difference?
Well, we're talking about proceedings in a court versus pretrial depositions. And in criminal, you wouldn't have pretrial, typically, I don't believe, have pretrial.
The reason I'm asking the question is, in reading the Stenger case,
it has a discussion, the Pennsylvania case, it has a discussion between the difference of the right of access, the public's right to access in a criminal proceeding as opposed to a civil proceeding. And it says the First and 14th Amendments implicitly guarantee the public a qualified right of access to a criminal trial, but not so with regard to a civil proceeding. And that made me come to mind when Justice Bablish asked the question of, I don't know, corruption or fraud or something, criminal proceedings, and it seemed to me that there may be a difference based on this discussion, and I'm asking you about that.
That's a good point. And what's happening in the case law there is, of course, I think it was Richmond, where they tried to address, does the Sixth Amendment permit a closed criminal trial, or can there be a requirement that it be open? And there has been greater development in the law on the criminal side than on the civil. So the right of access is greater defined on the criminal side than on the civil. Now I'm speaking to court proceedings as opposed to depositions.
Is there a First Amendment right for the media to gather information?
Well, I think the quote from Pell is right on point. Yes, the Constitution permits, of course, the press to gather information, but does not impose on the government the affirmative duty to make available to journalists sources of information not available to members of the public generally. So they have conceded they're in no greater position than the public, and while they're free to publish anything they like about this lawsuit that they can obtain through their ordinary sources, Judge Armato went farther and said, I'm going to use the power of the court to give you special access that has never been given before. There is no right of access, and so Judge Armato went beyond the law.
At the present time, could attorneys Robert Habish and David Lowe, who represent the plaintiffs in this action, just disseminate these depositions?
There is a stay in effect by this court that prevents them from doing that.
But before that?
No. Before that, yes. They were free to disseminate them. There had been an understanding that that wasn't going to happen, which is why Journal Sentinel went to court in the first place. They came to a deposition, and this is in the record from the Flowers deposition. Journal Sentinel said, we're here, we'd like to sit in. Mr. Habish said, I'm not going to agree to that unless all parties agree. All parties did not agree, and the Journal Sentinel was told, if you want access, you have to go to court, and they did.
Counsel, one way that this court, I think, could deal with this would be to deny the supervisory writ, but then continue the stay for a reasonable amount of time for Mitsubishi to apply for a protective order. What's wrong with that?
Because it puts the burden upside down. Journal Sentinel has to show what right it has as an intervener, what protectable legal interest it has. To put the burden on Mitsubishi to come in for protective order assumes there is a right that can be limited, and that doesn't exist. In fact, that issue came up in the Kimberlene versus Quinlan case at 145 F. Second. It's at footnote 2, a Judge Green decision out of the D.C. District. And there said, you don't need a protective order to exclude a non-party from attending a deposition. So they don't have a right to access. And thus the burden isn't on us to have a protective order and show good cause to prevent access. They have to come forward and show what protectable legal interest do they have, or does Doug Smith have, to get this access that has never been recognized before.
That sounds like you're putting all your eggs in one basket. And if we should hold that there is a protectable interest here, certainly maybe not up to the standards of the first, the height of the First Amendment, but some interest, why can't you go back to court? Well, what's wrong with you going back and getting a protective order?
Well, and if the court were to conclude that, we would like the opportunity to go back for protective order. But that's one of the consequences that Judge Armato's order doesn't anticipate, is let's think about this brave new world that's created and what we're doing to trial courts in the 72 counties if we recognize this right for the first time. if there's 45,000 civil filings last year, you can imagine the number of depositions that go on. And imagine the number of depositions in which perhaps the media might not be interested, but others will. Well, my neighbor's in a lawsuit, or some public celebrity is in a lawsuit. I'd like to get the transcript. I'd like to put it on the internet, as was done in this case. In each of those instances, if this new right of access exists, litigants have to run into court and get a protective order. Imagine the volume. Imagine what you're doing to the trial courts in this state. If you're forcing them to deal on a case-by-case, deposition-by-deposition basis with should this deposition transcript be put on the internet.
That would necessarily follow if we found that these were public documents. Because anybody can file a public record.
Yeah, actually not, because the public record, I mean, it isn't that clean, because the public record statute still incorporates the common law exceptions. And so one would argue, even if it were filed with the court, one could still argue the common law exceptions in all this law and statutes that say there is no right of access and thus is not automatically to be released. And also consider the consequences for third parties. Again, a party to a lawsuit perhaps can anticipate some loss of personal privacy rights. And we all have a right to be left alone. But that right to be left alone is lost when you receive a deposition subpoena. And so third parties are brought before the court reporter and made to testify under oath and asked to answer all kinds of potentially private, personal questions. If what do those parties do if there is this now new right of access? Do those parties have to hire a lawyer and go in and get a protective order in order to prevent their personal information from being disseminated across the internet?
Your red light's on, but since we don't have 20 minutes allotted to another party,
okay,
you may take the half hour and
okay,
we'll be within the range. So
thank you very much.
I should have told you that beforehand. I apologize.
Thank you. So, as I said, Judge Amato didn't read the history correctly. He didn't consider the Supreme Court pronouncements on this point, and he didn't fully appreciate the consequences. And I've touched on a couple of them. But what are we doing to the trial courts if this new right is recognized?
Mr. Weber, could I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
The position that you're advancing on the press's right to intervene to open up documents, does it require us to overrule the Builder case to the extent that it approved of that procedural device, or just to limit it?
No, actually, my position is perfectly consistent with Builder and Edson, because in those cases, you looked at 803.09 and said those were decided under public records statutes, whereby in those cases, the intervention was sought after the case was closed, and documents were in the court files. So the media could point to their rights under the public records statute. There is no such right here that they can point to. So it's completely consistent with Bill.
Your view on Seattle is that the First Amendment rights protected there are of the party who has the deposition in hand.
Right.
So there's some protection for those depositions, First Amendment protection.
Right. For the part, once you get access, as the parties did in Seattle Times, then the court talks about some balancing test being appropriate. Not strict scrutiny, but some balancing test being appropriate in deciding whether someone with proper access gets to dissent. So if plaintiffs were to decide, yes, we're going to release these, then that kind of balancing test might be appropriate. Now, there's another issue hanging out there that we've raised that really hasn't been addressed by anyone, and that is how you reconcile release of transcripts by a lawyer, with your Supreme Court Rule 20.3.6, which I know this court recently reviewed and reaffirmed. I mean, the point to me, it seems to me, of 23.6 is we recognize there are Sixth Amendment values at stake that we need to protect. That if we have wide open free-for-all, it can have an effect on trials. And so you limit what lawyers can talk about. And you suspended a judge, a lawyer's license for 2 years because of things he said, among other things. And so if there is value in limiting expression for Sixth Amendment purposes, don't those same values, aren't they triggered in what we're talking about here? Because if you're not supposed to talk about test results, if you're not supposed to talk about credibility of witness pursuant to 20.3.6, how does it make sense to say you can talk about those same things in the deposition transcript and then freely turn it over where it gets printed on the front page of the paper to the same effect?
Counsel, you've asked in your petition for supervisory writ, in your statement of issues and in your brief in support of it, you say, well, okay, the trial court erred in allowing intervention. You've discussed the legal arguments regarding intervention. You say the trial court erred in declaring that the depositions and others are public records, and you discussed the law regarding that. The third basis is that the trial court erred because the parties in the erred in ordering the parties in this litigation to give copies of deposition transcripts. Doesn't the trial court judge have discretion to order that kind of activity with regard to the litigants? What precludes the trial court judge? What legal authority do you have to advance that precludes the trial court judge from having the discretion to enter that order?
Because he's not doing so pursuant to any protectable legal interest. I mean, he can't order...
Protectable legal interest is with regard to intervention. Let's say you're right. He can't allow them to intervene. Let's say you're right. These are not public records. But the trial... We give lots of discretion to trial judges. And maybe the judge in the balancing test, regardless of whether there was intervention, regardless of whether these are public records, has the discretion to order litigants to give copies of transcripts and depositions in high-profile cases.
I don't know what you would put on one side of the balance to bring that about.
Well, Justice Babbage asked in his question, here you have a case where there's a high amount of public interest involving payment expenditure of tax dollars. Just in the public interest.
Right. Well, is it in the public interest? You know, could the trial court say to me, Mr. Weber, you know, you're a party, you're a prominent person in this litigation, I'd like you to release your tax records so that people know a little bit more about you. He'd say, well, wait a minute, what are we trying to accomplish? And there has to be a protectable legal interest in the balance.
And if the trial court balanced, God forbid that he do that with regard to your records, but balanced and said, yes, on balance, I think I will do that. What legal authority do you have to advance today that the trial court does not have that kind of power?
Because I've been pointed to no statute, no common law tradition, no right for the trial court to do that. The trial court can't make up mandates and duties out of the air.
Well, let me give you it. I asked you whether or not the trial court could order these depositions to be filed.
Right?
You said yes.
Yes.
So now that, in effect, they're on file, now, why can't the trial court say they're on file, they're in the record, they're to be released? You've made no showing, no one's made a showing or asked for protective order, I'm releasing them. The only thing he didn't do here was pull them in, but in effect, he exercised control over them.
We would have the right to a review of that activity and might ask fairly, why are you doing this? Why are you setting up this procedure that runs counter to centuries of tradition, statutes, and common law? Trial court, why are you doing this?
Because I have discretion over how this case is going to proceed. I have discretion about discovery matters. I want to be sure that this court has a full and complete record here and that one reason we don't file depositions is because they take too much space and it's a warehousing issue. This is an important case. I want it in the courthouse. I don't want it in some lawyer's offices. I want it here. You can keep your own copies. So you please bring them in.
Right.
Now, if I went that far, you probably would not object. You would just turn them over.
I would say, Judge, you're acting pursuant to your adjudicative authority.
Right.
You want, for your purposes, the complete record.
Right.
And so it's here and it's available to you as your... So you can do your job.
Right.
I understand that. And... but we're talking about going beyond that. He's not doing his job. And really,
now,
we're talking
now
about...
Now I got him as the trial judge. They're
right.
In the courthouse. Now I say I'm going to release them.
And then we would have a right to object, and the release would be reviewable.
Release would be reviewable. What would your objection be, that you need a protective order to protect against tainting the jury?
In part, yes.
All right. What are the other parts?
Interests of the third parties that are not represented, that whose privacy rights are at stake. But particularly in a case like this, the Sixth Amendment rights are
Sixth
very
Amendment
powerful.
Sixth Amendment is fair trial?
Yes.
Okay,
right.
Well, we did that. I mean, for the moment.
Right. Because, I mean, as you've seen in the papers, these materials were released at 2 o'clock one day, and at 5 o'clock that night, the reporters were on television with transcripts in hand. Both headlines in the Sunday Journal Sentinel, the lead and the sub-lead for Thanksgiving Day, were about here's what they said in the transcripts. So this isn't some potential problem.
What would the standard be on review? When the trial judge first makes his decision and then upon a balancing of interests?
Well, if there...
A balancing and find it in the open record, in the public record?
I think if there is a protectable legal interest that he is acting pursuant to and not something he's made up, then yes, it would be. Was there a showing of good cause to prevent dissemination?
But that, now that gets me back to where I was about 20 minutes ago. It seems to me, correct me if I'm looking at this wrong. It seems to me that if we find that there is no protectable legal interest, you have only cleared the first hurdle. Because if we should find that these are public documents, then anybody can make a public records request. Is that correct?
I mean, if you were to read the statute that way, then yes, the mechanisms that govern release of public records then would be triggered.
But I'm saying you could win your protectable legal interest argument, but still lose this case if we were to say that depositions, videotapes, etc., are public records.
Right.
That is correct. Sure.
But and then there's the third part, and that is that even if you win on protectable legal interest issue, and even if you win on the public records issue, that is, it's not public records,
right.
Then you've got the third issue. Does the trial court nevertheless have discretion to do this? So you could win on the first two and still lose on the third. Are we seeing the issues correctly? I mean, am I correct in stating that you could win on the first two, but that still leads you to jump the hurdle of the third issue of dealing with trial
court
discretion?
We don't get to the judge's exercise of discretion if you conclude there's no protectable legal interest. You conclude, you resolve this case by saying Journal Sentinel shouldn't have been allowed to intervene. Centuries of traditions and statutes say this is not something that the public has access to. The case is over. What happens next, we'll have to wait and see.
I understood in the statement of issues that you have on page 1 of your brief is, did the court violate controlling precedent and tradition, etc., when it orally, number 1, allowed the Journal Sentinel to intervene in this action? Number 2, declared that the deposition transcripts, videotapes, and exhibits are public records. And 3, ordered the parties in this litigation to give copies of deposition transcripts, videotapes, and exhibits to the press.
Right. And going back to your point, we would not say that he has discretion to do that, because he doesn't have discretion to do something which has no basis in law. Trial judges aren't free just to go and create new rights.
Trial judges can't exercise discretion in violation of the law. That's an erroneous exercise of discretion. But if there's no law that prescribes the activity, that prohibits the activity, then I assume we defer to the discretion of the trial court. Unless it's erroneously exercised.
Right. But again, discretion implies balancing. Balancing implies some protectable legal interest as opposed to a curiosity.
Thank you, Mr. Grebby. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Bush, you have, if you wish it, you don't have to feel obliged to take it a half hour.
Thank you. May it please the court. John A. Bush, and with me in court is my partner, Stephen Ritt, my colleague, Mr. Christopher Mormon from Michael Best and Friedrich, and Mr. Paul Kreitzer, who's the general counsel of the Journal Company. Before I get to the substance of my comments, I'd like to put this in an appropriate procedural posture. Several weeks ago, Mitsubishi went before Judge Amato and sought a gag order in relation to 5 employees of Mitsubishi, alleging before the court that should the identity and the content of their depositions be made public, those individuals may be subjected to physical threat. Based upon that, and a showing of good cause, Judge Amato issued a gag order, that was not ultimately put into writing. Subsequently, at the invitation of one of the parties, the Journal Sentinel showed up at a non-Mitsubishi deposition, a Lamson deposition. And this is all documented in the deposition of Mr. Flowers. At that deposition, the question went around. It said, Journal Sentinel is here. They want to come in. Does anyone object? During that deposition, which is in the record right now, one of the parties said, we believe that the breadth of this gag order is so broad that no one can disseminate any information with regard to this case until 30 days after all depositions are taken. Mr. Habish came out, talked to Mr. Lampe, said, "Everybody, we have to have a clarification of the gag order because we don't believe, absent the intervention of the court, we can disseminate information." Within 3 days of that occurrence, we were in court seeking intervention, in part for a clarification of a gag order, which was interpreted by some of the parties to prevent dissemination. We stood there as a member of the public to get a clarification of that order. While we were there, we also sought further. We stood, citing Seattle Times, said that we believed, as a representative of the public, in a case of such high interest and magnitude, we would not only like to have it clarified that the parties could give and disseminate information, but we'd also like to have direct access to it as well. Now, we weren't the only people who spoke at that particular hearing. Mr. Stearman, Mr. Habish's partner, was also asked to address what he thought about dissemination at that point in time. And I'm looking at the record, our Appendix 18. Because one of the things that was argued by Mr. Weber at that time was, look, Your Honor, you don't have to worry about this ultimately coming out, because a year from now, in September of the year 2000, there are going to be motions for summary judgment. All of this will be filed, and then it'll be available to the public. And here's what Mr. Stearman said. Quote, what's going to happen is the affidavits and the testimony is then going to be filed September 1st, that's the year 2000. And for the first time, all of those documents are going to be made public right before the trial, and that's going to be a lot worse, in my opinion, than anything that comes out 1 year before trial. Here's his last line. I would rather have it come out now. This is a party. I would rather have it come out now than come out right before the trial. Judge Amato sat there. He listened to the arguments of the parties. And if you look at the latter part of his decision, you'll see what he did. He's sitting there He knows that ultimately there's going to be a summary judgment motion filed, and he knows that ultimately, whether you look at it under Chapter 19 or you look at it under Chapter 54, they're going to be public records, and it's going to be a splash if there is to be a splash. And so what he says is, you know, I have authority, and I will cite authority that Mr. Weber didn't cite, 804016, custody of civil documents. Unless the court, in any action, orders otherwise, the original copies of all depositions, interrogatories, requests for admissions, etc., shall be retained by the party. And what Judge Amato, exercising his discretion, did was he said, you know, you don't own that, Mr. Weber. You don't own that, Mr. Habish. You only are the custodian of that. I control it under 804016. And exercising my authority under 804016, I'm going to order, absent a showing of good cause, I'm going to order that you turn that over at this stage, that you allow it to be disseminated, except for the gag order, and that you turn it over to the Journal Sentinel, because, frankly, I'm weighing all the interests here, and that's the side that I come out on. And by the way, Mr. Stearman, who is Mr. Rotier's partner sitting in the audience, Mr. Stearman, who chose not even to show up here today, Mr. Stearman's the man who said, if it's going to come out, I'd rather have it come out now. That's a party. Now, the judge also said, and this cannot be lost, I'm doing this subject to any party's right to come forward and articulate to me good cause why it shouldn't occur. It was an open invitation. It was the way in which it should be done. Mr. Weber was the man who chose not to bring a motion for good cause. What does he do? He runs up to the Court of Appeals, invoking the horrors associated with an allegation that, in fact, there was going to be some tainting of the jury associated with this news story. And the Court of Appeals, after due deliberation, rejects the writ that he sought.
Let me ask you, as long as you're covering that, and you're talking about something that potentially this is a major case, so the case of this magnitude, Mr. Or opposing counsel made the argument that, you know, this is something that is going to affect not only this case, but most, if not all, other civil side cases. And in that area, it is a concern, it seems to me, and having been a trial judge for 13 years, about the juror pool. Now, this is a case that everyone knows about. I think anyone that's been a resident of the state of Wisconsin over a number of months. But you get a case that maybe is up north, and the person, public or press, walks in and gets that and makes it a point of major public knowledge. What do you think is going to happen to the juror pool? Do you think it's not going to be affected, or do you think it's a concern that this court shouldn't even get into?
No, I think it's an absolute concern this court should get into. And that's why I think you should give deference to the man sitting at the helm, Judge Amato, because this very issue was presented to him. I mean, Mr. Stearman laid it right out there. Because one thing we have to take into consideration is that unless the court is going to say that once something is filed, it's going to put a seal on it, that it will be subject to the purview of the public. And at that point in time, what Mr. Stearman talked about was, I would rather have it come out over time than I would have a splash just before the trial, because if it's a splash just before the trial, there's more of a possibility of a taint. To go back to this whole issue.
Splash before the trial or during the trial? I guess that's the question. When you talk about a trial, as I recall, the testimony came in during the trial. This splash is, as you said, I think opposing counsel, the major, apparently major news stories on it, and may continue. But that's what I think. During a trial, there's normally the splash is after the jury has been chosen. Not before.
Well, except that may be true in the absence of a large summary judgment motion. The summary judgment motion at that point in time, the documents, including all the affidavits, will come in, and that's the point I was making, Your Honor.
Right, but then the party at that point, Mr. Bush, knows that by making the application to the court for the order of summary judgment, he is going to necessarily have to disclose what are otherwise non-public materials, and understands that when he makes the motion and either files it in connection with a motion to keep part of the record sealed and takes his chances on that part of the motion, or files an understanding that this is going to effectuate a disclosure of otherwise non-public materials, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that's precisely the choice that was given to Judge Amato. And what Judge Amato did and what he ultimately decided to do was that absent a showing of good cause, in light of all the factors that were before him, he was going to order its disclosure and invited Mr. Weber to come forward with a substantiated motion for protective order, which Mr. Weber chose not to do.
Counsel, do you concede that the media has no greater right of access to any judicial proceeding or document than does any other citizen?
For the purposes of this case, yes, Your Honor.
Do you concede that no private citizen would have a right to access to these documents?
No. And
so, in other words, if my Aunt Mildred wanted access to these depositions, or wanted access to these depositions, it's your position that she has a legal right of access to those depositions?
And if so,
what's the authority for that?
Well, under the ruling of the court as it was articulated, a couple of things. One is, I think the court itself has the statutory authority to so order. And that's what the judge did.
Yeah, that's number three. That's the discretion. I'm getting to number one. Whether or not there is a right of access.
I believe there is, number one, I'm referring
to the statement.
I understand. I believe there is a right of access, and I think...
What legal authority do you have to offer that my Aunt Mildred has a legal right of access to these depositions at this stage of the proceeding?
Seattle Times had the following quote: "It is, of course, clear that information obtained through civil discovery, authorized by modern rules of civil procedure, would rarely, if ever, fall within the classes of unprotected speech identified by decisions of this court. In this case, as petitioners argue, there certainly is a public interest in knowing more about the respondents." So if it's a matter of public interest, I think it's there.
So it's your position that regardless that Seattle Times focuses on dissemination, regardless that Seattle Times involved a party, the media being a party, that if it's a matter of public interest, you're advocating the position that it's a matter of public interest. Any member of the public has a right, a legal right, to access to those pretrial depositions at this stage of the proceeding.
Has a legal right to assert a right of access, subject to the balancing done by a court under good cause. And I would cite the court to not only Seattle Times, but its progeny, Anderson versus Krivak, In Re Consumer Power, Hawley versus Hall, Citizens First National Bank. And particularly in Citizens First National Bank, which was decided in 1999, Judge Easterbrook, the Seventh Circuit, said, of course there's an interest. The very nature of a trial is that it's conducted under the auspices of the state, and that the public, any time that the state is involved, the public has an interest. It's not to suggest that the rights of private parties can't be used to trump it, but the balancing that's used is good cause.
I have a follow-up question to the quote that you just read, Mr. Bush, from Seattle Times. Didn't that refer to the right of the speaker, the First Amendment rights of the speaker,
as opposed
to the press to obtain access?
That case talked about that particularly. Seattle Times can be read to be limited to dissemination by a party, but I don't think that the progeny of it, the cases that I cited, certainly are invoked by the Boston Globe, they were invoked by the Las Vegas newspaper. It has been clearly the First, Seventh Circuits, and the district courts that I cited have not limited it to that particular application. And indeed, I think the concurring opinion, the first line of the concurring opinion, indicates that today the court holds that the First Amendment does have application to discovery process.
That was Brennan and Marshall.
Right.
It was concurrence.
Right. But I don't want to be hoist my entire case on whether or not there's First Amendment rights here. I don't think the court has to go to those First Amendment rights. I mean, as I said before, what I'm talking about here is the fact that the court, exercising its discretion in regard to its control over the documents, which clearly it has discretion to do not only at common law, but under our rules and our statutes, made an independent decision. The best way to handle this in light of all that was going on, in light of the fact that a lot of this was going to come out a year from now when truly public records, as defined under Section 19 and under 54, come, that the best way of handling it would be allow for the dissemination, allow for its publication, subject to a party coming forward and articulating good cause.
Counsel, you read language from the Seattle Times case in furtherance, I think, of the proposition that there's a right to access, the First Amendment right to access. I'm looking at the case, and it says, judicial limitations on a party's ability to disseminate, and I'm reading page 19, 47 U.S., 467, judicial limitations on a party's ability to disseminate information discovered in advance of trial implicates the First Amendment rights. And goes on to say, to, I think, suggest, if not say, that a litigant, well, it says here, a litigant has no First Amendment right to access to information made available only for purposes of trying this suit.
Well, and that's been the subject of a great deal of discussion in the courts below, because you notice it says a litigant doesn't have access to it. And I think what they're really saying there is that if you go on to read it, the only way I interpret it is the only way in which a litigant has access is through the civil procedures. And with the civil procedures come into play the whole host of protections, including Rule 26 of the federal rules. And let's don't forget that this case also has dissemination aspects to it. You recall the reason why we went into court in the first place was because we were told that someone interpreted the gag order, which had not been put into writing, to suggest that none of the parties could actually disseminate the information. It was in part in clarification of that that we went to the court. When we got to the court, we asked for other relief. And that other relief was granted in part based upon the input of parties to the case. I think we do have a First Amendment right, but this case doesn't have to rise or fall on our First Amendment rights in regard to this. I mean, this case can rise or fall, and I think it should rise or fall, based upon the inherent and express authority that's given to a trial judge. It seems to me that particularly in the context of supervisory writ, where the four criteria for its issuance, this is the wrong time and place for this to occur. The criteria are that an appeal is utterly inadequate. What record has Mr. Weber created? None. Why didn't he go in front of Judge Amato and seek a protective order, which, if not granted, could be viewed by the Court of Appeals and ultimately by you on a level that we're all aware of, abuse of discretion?
Well, he's essentially saying, Mr. Weber is essentially saying, you shouldn't have to put me through those hoops. You don't have a protectable legal interest ab initio.
Well, we certainly, I think, have a protectable legal interest in regard to dissemination. I mean, I think that's a protected right under Seattle.
Yeah.
And that's in part why we went in there. When we were in there, a whole host of things occurred. I mean, the record's pretty clear what happened in respect to what went on in there. And one of the parties themselves said, look, if we're going to talk about dissemination, they stood up and said, we would rather have them released to the public now as opposed to later on.
Right, but that's the right of the party, Mr. Bush. Dissemination is the right of the party. And to the extent that that needed to be clarified, it would have been one of the party's obligation to go into court and get a clarification of the order. When we're talking about the press's rights here, it's the right of access, which gets back to the first threshold issue here, which is, are these public records? And if it's conceded that they are not, then the public has no right of access whatsoever.
I don't think this rises or falls on whether or not these are public records. I think this case rises or falls on the discretion that's exercised by the trial court. I respectfully disagree that in issues of dissemination, I think we do have a right, and we do stand in the right of the public to come in and talk about dissemination, which I think is a right that's clearly articulated in
the
Seattle Times.
So your position is the press has a right to go to court to enforce a litigant's right of dissemination. Dissemination which may be in violation of the Supreme Court rules on lawyers?
I don't think that dissemination is in violation of the...
That has to be handled on a case-by-case basis, clearly. But the rule is implicated, obviously, when a lawyer disseminates anything that's obtained in discovery, is it not?
If one reads, I'll just put it this way. The way I read the progeny of Seattle Times, the ones that I've quoted, including the First Circuit in Anderson versus Krajewik, the Seventh Circuit in the Cincinnati financial case, the Hawley v. Hall, which is the Las Vegas case, the In Re Consumer Powers case, the answer to your question is yes, we have the right to be there. We have the right to be there as part of the public. Not only I think we have a right to do that arising out of the Constitution, I think we stand in this court's decisions, Edson and Builder, we are an appropriate party to at least come forward and advance these issues. Once it's aired, and I don't mean ER, I mean AIR, once you're in court and it's aired and there's a discussion, I think you have to look at the record of what occurred. The court didn't necessarily go off on and make its decision based upon some finding of First Amendment rights in particular. It was addressing a whole host of issues and really serving what I believe to be the articulation, although there was no proof of it, of Mr. Weber's concern, which is how do we best handle something that's going to be an issue of public discourse, how best to handle it.
But it's not clear that all of these depositions are going to become a part of the public record, is it?
No, and that's why I think the court said, open invitation, the last thing it said was, if Mr. Weber or any party has a problem with this at any point in time, come on in, get a protective order, and good cause. This is not an order that's going to sit there. It's not one that's in stone such that it can't be looked at otherwise.
But they won't know if they've got a need for a protective order until after the deposition is taken, and if there's an open invitation that the press can sit in.
No. Excuse me. We don't have an invitation to sit in.
That's how this started, isn't it?
No, if anyone objects, I'm not saying we have a right to sit in the deposition. As a matter of fact, the rules that are in play right now are there's a protective order that any of these transcripts have to go through a cleansing by the parties where they have the right to redact anything they want that fits within the protective order, and only then is it allowed to be seen by us. There's a whole process that's in place with regard to that. So there are at least two protective orders in place right now, one of them with regard to the gag order, and the other one, which is a negotiated one between the parties that the court signed, and we don't get access to those until after it's gone through that cleansing.
Can I ask one follow-up question? I'm sorry. If you were representing with one of your non-media clients in a high-profile piece of litigation, and this sort of a procedure was in place, would you think that's good law?
Your Honor, I love to control procedures. I love to keep things quiet when I'm representing Mr. Weber. I certainly don't criticize Mr. Weber for what he's doing. But the fact of the matter is, that's not what the court ordered. That's not what the court's discretion was. That's not, I believe, what the Constitution says. I mean, there are a lot of things that, as a private litigant, I would like to do. But the fact of the matter is, the rules of the Constitution and the court's discretion don't always fall my way. That's how it goes.
Could I ask a question? I'm still not clear whether the Law Journal Sunday is a full-fledged party here.
Your Honor, if you read what the court said, and I'll go back to one of the points that Mr. Weber said, where he was confused when the court said he believed that our intervention was moot, and I think I can reconcile that in light of what went on the record, and that is he independently, if you read through it, he independently made the decision inherent in his power and under the statutes, that the best way to handle this, in light of everything that's gone on, including the discussion by Mr. Stearman that he would rather have a dispenser or disseminate it now, he independently made the decision, I am going to order these disclosed until someone comes forward and gives good cause otherwise. And that's when I think he looked to me and said, Mr. Bush, that kind of makes your intervention moot, does it not? Now, in order to give it life, and in order to take into consideration what I believed he was saying, I'm the one, frankly, who drafted the order that I submitted to him at his request. I think it says in it, you know, intervention solely for the purposes of this order or something to that effect. Thank you, Rob. The General Sentinel has the right to intervene for the limited purpose of establishing its interest relative to the matters. I'm the one who drafted that. It went around and no one objected to it.
And what authority would you point to in the statute for that limited intervention?
Well, I believe 80309 allows us to do that, particularly as interpreted in the Edson case and in the Builder case, where, frankly, the press and in the La Crosse case, the La Crosse Times case, and the Newspapers Inc. cases, all the cases in which the newspapers are given the authority to intervene solely for the purposes of advancing the public's interest, I would suggest to you that maybe that's not the term that it's my term, and I apologize for its lack of artistry, but I believe that's particularly what we're talking about. I mean, in Edson and in Builder, they wanted to go and open up public records, and it wasn't for the purposes of attempting to appeal. It wasn't for the purposes of being a full-blown party. It was to get some specific information. And I believe that's really the basis of the concept that I tried to articulate, which is limited intervention.
I think you may have been following the language of 803.091, which is one of the subsections that says, on timely motion, anyone shall be permitted to intervene in an action when the movement claims an interest relating to the property or transaction. And then it goes on to say that the movement has the ability to protect that interest. So I assume that you're just talking about a particular interest, not how you saw it.
You wanted to make it very clear, and I was asked during...
You're not asking for the Journal Sentinel to be a party for the rest of the litigation.
No.
With all the rights.
No, Your Honor.
You're not asking, I think, but maybe you better tell me, you're not asking that you appear, be able to appear at every deposition.
No, specifically we are not asking for it.
So what you're asking for is a release of depositions subject to good cause, shown that they should not be released.
That's what we asked for. I'm not so sure it was granted simply at our request. I think it was also the court ab initio looking at the whole situation. And frankly, we weren't the only people who asked for that. I mean, as I read, Mr. Stearman himself in open court asked for that.
Seems to me he can release it if I'm reading Seattle Times right, and I think you can read it in a number of ways. At least one way of reading it is that he can release anything he wants as the lawyer for a party, as long as there's no protective order saying no.
Well, that's what brought us to the court in the first place, because there was no written gag order, and the problem was, and I believe you can see it in Mr. Fowler's deposition, where everyone says we're not doing anything unless we get a clarification of that. And that's what started this whole thing.
I want to get into the practical effect of what it is you're asking us to do with that. Depositions are freewheeling things. A lot of questions are asked and answers are given, to which objection is given, and go ahead, you may answer the question. You know how all that goes. So a lot of stuff gets into that record, into that deposition that will not even appear at trial, will not even go into evidence, but some of which may seriously infringe upon privacy rights of individuals. Now, you're representing a client who is, let's say, a witness in a case, not a party. And at the deposition, some scurrilous stuff goes into it, some stuff that could embarrass your client. Now, how do you go about protecting your client from the release of these records? How will you even know that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is asking for these records?
Well, with regard to, I'll talk generally, then I'll talk specifically with regard to this case. Clearly, the language you just used, embarrassment, scurrilous, those are, I think, at least embarrassment is taken right out of 80401 with regard to a protective order, number one. Number two, with regard to dissemination, that's been a, that's as far
I'm
as...
I'm asking how you even know that there is the, that these records are going to be released. Do you have a right to notice?
I don't think you have a right to notice under the current statutes. The fact of the matter is that that's true right now, I suggest, that when we're talking about dissemination, if you go back to Seattle Times, it says that anyone can disseminate information.
Well, then if you're going to represent your client properly, aren't you going to advise your client don't answer that question under any circumstance?
I think one would say that we would, I think the proper procedure, if we were concerned about it, would be as
yeah, I'm concerned, that's why I asked.
You would say, I would like to postpone and adjourn this deposition subject to my ability to go get a protective order. And frankly, pick up the phone and probably access the judge and get it done. But that's a risk that exists irrespective of what occurs here today.
But don't you see that as a huge burden on the courts? Something that, I mean, when you figure the number of lawsuits that are active in any given day, the number of depositions that are being taken, in order to protect the client, that I'm not sure that the court had the resources.
Well, I think that could easily have been handled by Judge Armato if he had simply said, you know what? What you're asking is just too burdensome. And it would have been over. We wouldn't be here. It would all be over with.
Well, let's go back to Justice Ballard's example. So there's a witness, and the deposition is being taken, and lots of things are discussed. May never be introduced into evidence, but allowed on discovery. Suppose you just go ahead and you say it all, and then you say, listen, then I'm going to intervene under 803.091, because after all, I'm now a movement that has, according to your interpretation, an interest, right?
Yes.
Move that my deposition be placed under seal, that is, there's a protective order that the parties cannot distribute all or part of my deposition.
May I answer that?
Yes.
I don't think you have to intervene. I think the protective orders allows not only parties, but people who are witnesses to seek that. I mean, I think it's all set forth. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
You seem to brush off the concern with respect to what I guess we call the second issue, that whether or not these are public records. Yet when I read Judge Amato's decision, his oral decision, there's no question in my mind that he said these are public records. He says, quote, the lawyers who hold these depositions are custodians of public records of the court in the civil action. And then two paragraphs later, he says, because this is a public forum and these documents are public records. Now, if in fact he's correct, then Aunt Mildred has the right to come in at any time. Now,
I didn't mean, if I appeared to brush off, I apologize, first of all. But with regard to the public records issue, I think a strong case, and I think, frankly, the Court of Appeals looked at this issue. I think a strong case can be made that these are public records, but our case doesn't rise or fall on whether these are public records. I think what he was saying, the way I interpret what he says, if you go further, he examines what used to happen in the old procedures in regard to the filing of depositions. What he said, I think what he's saying is, this is how I interpret it, I can convert these at any point in time to public records simply by ordering that they be filed. But instead of doing that, because of the housekeeping problems that arise in respect to that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to exercise my authority under 804.061. He didn't invoke it, I'm using that, but he clearly talks about it, and say, we're going to put certain conditions on their disclosure. I control it. He did say, Mr. Weber and others, hold them solely as at the pleasure of the court, which I think is accurate. So I don't mean to brush off the issue of public records. I think really public records
can be viewed as somewhat of a red herring here because he can convert them to public.
So what is your case? You are saying you have a protectable legal interest, period, whether these are public records or not.
Yes.
And therefore, you have a right to them.
I have a right to advance my right to them.
Exactly. And then allow the judge to make the balance.
Yes.
Can I ask some of the questions? On 80309, there's a lot of reliance on 80309.1. When we get down to 3, it says, a person desiring to intervene shall serve a motion to intervene upon the parties as provided in Section 801.14. The motion shall state the grounds therefore and shall be accompanied by a pleading setting forth the claim or defense for which intervention is sought. How did the Journal Sentinel deal with that last sentence?
I don't think we put forth a complaint. I think we articulated it in the context of our brief. With regard to the, I would invoke hopefully the liberal rules with regard to pleading. Frankly, that's never been raised before. I don't think we did put in a complaint. I don't think that's fatal to our position, because as I said before, I don't think this case rises or falls on our right to intervene. I think it rises or falls on the discretion of the court. But I did not, to my recollection, did not put in a complaint.
Counsel,
the
Chief Mayor. I'm concerned about the ramifications. This is a big case, but the bread and butter cases in circuit courts all around the state can be affected by this ruling. You have lawsuits, a personal injury lawsuit, where depositions are taken and things are said that are wouldn't necessarily be publicized. You have lawsuits of a son suing a father in the transfer of the family-owned business, where all sorts of unpleasantries may be exchanged that you wouldn't necessarily want publicized. And yet, if we hold as you are advocating, I assume the newspaper has a right to access to those depositions with the proper showing, has a right to access to those depositions. Well, it's a slow news day in Eau Claire, you know, and hey, I see on the docket a lawsuit was filed, and I'm going to wait for a couple of months and see what those depositions say. It's someone suing Attorney Smith for malpractice, or it's some, as I said, son suing his father. That might make a nice personal interest story. All of that's available. Huh?
If the information is filed?
Pre-filing.
Okay.
Pre-filing. Post-deposition, but pre-filing.
If it's pre-filed, then the only way we get it, we don't have a right to go to Mr. Weber independently and say, Mr. Weber, you have to turn it over to me. We have to go to court and assert our rights in the first instance. And to me, a judge can say, I'm sorry, no, it's too burdensome, I don't want to deal with it. And beyond, that's the exercise of his or her discretion. I don't see how we get beyond it. I think if we're talking about issues of public concern and what the ramifications are that are to come forth from this court, I suggest there's one that's even more overriding than that. And that is where a court, trial court, faced with all the records that were before him, and in a case like this, exercises his or her discretion in a way in which I think is comports with all the things that were put forward, I think to issue a writ, a supervisory writ that says as a matter of law he or she was wrong, that to me I think sends a wrong message to the trial court as opposed to the minimal burden that would result from the fact that if I wanted to get deposition transcripts that were in the hands of lawyers, I had to go to a judge who could very easily say it's not worth the case, it's not worth the burden, the answer is no. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bush. Mr. Weber.
Thank you. With respect to what happened at the hearing in front of Judge Amato, I think it's pretty clear on the transcript. And Justice, you get it right on the nose. What he said was, these are public records, and my decision is governed by that, by virtue of his misunderstanding of the historical treatment of those transcripts. So all this discussion about, well, maybe it would be better to have it come out now rather than later, wasn't anything that Judge Amato talked about, wasn't the basis for his decision, wasn't the kind of a balancing of interests. He said, these are public records, and everything follows from that. With respect to what the parties might do, I don't believe that the parties voluntarily will disseminate these materials. They haven't done it, and I don't think they will, because they want to keep the case in, plaintiffs want to keep the case in Milwaukee County. And Judge Amato has said, if you talk to the press and you pollute the jury pool, you will not be heard to complain if I need to get a different panel. So I think plaintiffs understand what will occur if they begin releasing these voluntarily. So I think the parties will continue to hold them, and there will be protective order issues won't come
up. Regardless of who releases them, suppose the court releases them and the pool is tainted. The plaintiffs are in the same spot. They should be joining you then, if that's the position.
Well, they were invited to come here today, and they elected not to. You can look at the transcript of Flowers' deposition, where plaintiff's counsel said, I'm not going to agree to their release unless everyone stipulates, and if you don't, you go to court. So that's, I think that's where we're at. In terms of the progeny of Seattle Times, with all respect to the counsel, it doesn't hold what he said. If you look at, for example, the first case he cites, Anderson versus Cryorack, 805 F. 2nd, at 13, he discusses this very point, the common law presumption of public access. And the First Circuit says, the courts have not extended, insert access, beyond materials on which a court relies in determining the litigant's substantive rights. And skipping down, we decline to extend the materials used only in discovery, the common law presumption that the public may inspect judicial records. Anderson actually pushes the bar farther. It says, simply the fact that it's a judicial record doesn't mean you have access. They push it later in the spectrum of it has to be used in part of the, as part of the judicial process. Because ultimately, what we're talking about is a timing of disclosure issue. Counsel, we're going through this process now, gathering all this information, trying to figure out what occurred. And at some point in the future, at trial, the parties will decide what is the critical information. And at that time, the information will be released.
Right, that's not just a timing decision. That's a control and content decision,
it
however,
is. Right.
Which is the important, well, two additional important points.
Exactly.
And that's in the hands of the parties, and you would argue that's where it should be rather than with the judge?
Yes. Because, as Justice said, these are, as Justice wrote and Justice Bradley said, we're at the stage now that these are uncontradicted assertions bereft of cross-examination and the introduction of contrary evidence. Anybody can come into a deposition and say anything, and they will, and they have.
Well,
whether that bears any relationship, an objective observer would agree to reality, is what the rules of evidence and the trial process is all about.
But then isn't the answer to that that the judge himself or herself will simply say, can't have it. I've conducted a balancing, and this has not been subject to cross-examination. Isn't your relief with the court?
Well, it really isn't. Again, as we talked about earlier, that there is no, they can't shift the burden to us to show on a case-by-case, deposition-by-deposition basis that each deposition shouldn't be released. And it's no answer to say, and for the Eau Claire example, well, you go to the Eau Claire judge, and the Eau Claire judge can say, no, I don't think this is a matter of public interest. The burden is too great. I mean, can you imagine a media lawyer accepting that answer? I wouldn't. I'd say, no, you don't get to define what the public interest is. I have a right under the Mitsubishi case, and you have to give it to me.
You
want to say it's too burdensome is not the answer. Hire more staff. So the 72 counties now will be inundated with requests from the media and Aunt Mildred for every case that they have a curiosity about.
You want a bright line rule that says these are non-public until they're filed in court.
Right. That's what the law has been for centuries. Judge Amato departed from the centuries tradition, and I think we made a mistake.
Can the judge order them in under 804.016? Unless the court in any action orders otherwise, the original copies of all depositions, interrogatories, etc., and any other discovery documentation shall be retained by the party who initiated this discovery.
I believe they would. You're talking about a procedural statute that says, how are we going to handle our business? And really, maybe there's another solution to this problem, which is, if we should overturn centuries of case law and tradition, then maybe it ought to be done through a fact-finding and legislative process. So it's not just Journal Sentinel and Mitsubishi talking about it. It's either this court, through its rules-making process, which are themselves conducted in the open, and the Trial Judges Association can come and talk to you about the implications on that, or what is really the tradition in the state, which is the legislature decides what is a public record and what are the terms of access. So if we're to overturn centuries of common law and statutes, let's do it in a different setting. Let's bring it before the legislature and have hearings, or do it by rulemaking, and again in an open process where you can consider the impact on everyone.
Well, you know, this is originally a rule here. 67 was second, 585, and then there's been some statutes after that, and apparently some rules after that. But the rule is quite clear. It says, unless the court orders otherwise, the attorney keeps the depositions. Why here, in effect, didn't Judge Amato rule otherwise and say, bring them in and turn them over?
Because he misunderstood the law.
Well,
He didn't look at this and say, I have discretion to bring them in and thereby create them as judicial records. He said, deposition transcripts are public records. But traditionally, they were filed with the court. He didn't realize that they were filed under seal, apparently. And therefore, it's just a matter of administrative convenience. They remain public records.
Well, are they filed with the court or aren't they?
They're not.
They are not. So what's this under seal?
Until 1976, from 1878 to 76, they were filed with the court and filed under seal. Even now, the court reporter seals the judge's copy. So if you use it in court and want to impeach somebody, go through the process of opening it up.
But does that history and do those statutes answer the question about whether these are public documents or non-public documents? Or do they just speak to who's the custodian and how do we preserve the chain of custody?
Which statutes?
The ones that you're talking about, and the historical statute about filing depositions under seal.
Well,
and then its successor, which is this one, which talks about who's the custodian.
Right. Well, the statute, going back to literally the Judiciary Act of 1789 forward, talks about the mechanism for handling this material and reflects the common law tradition that there is not a right of access to it. And so our statutes continue that tradition. It's exactly the converse of what Judge Amato thought. And again, the history is very well laid out in Judge Scalia's opinion and the other California district court.
This statute doesn't even talk about custody. It just says retain. As if custody were somewhere else.
It's in the... That's where I'm looking. It talks about the custody of discovery documents, and that's why I raised the point that I did about whether this just speaks to who the custodian is and how we're going to preserve the integrity of these documents, not whether or not they are public or private documents.
Right. The context of this is how do we, the days before photocopying and et cetera, how do we protect the integrity of these documents? And it used to be put a red seal on it and send it to court. And now there's greater confidence that they can be retained by the attorneys. So no, it takes these statutes out of context if you were to read them as overturning this centuries of tradition. Rather, I think you need to read them in the context of, you know, against an extraordinary statement that, hey, you know what, we in Wisconsin, we're going to take a different path. I recognize what's been done since the Judiciary Act of 1789, but we're going to change the rule. We're going to do it by court rule, or we're going to do it by legislation, or I don't think you should. You could do it by common law. In the absence of any of that occurring, and it hasn't, I don't think it's fair to read anything in these statutes as overturning the centuries of tradition. And for all the reasons I said of the incredible consequences for trial courts across the state and third-party rights, not to mention those against Sixth Amendment rights and the other concerns, we shouldn't use this case to change the law. Again, it's a very high-profile case. But hard cases make bad law. If you overturn centuries of tradition, because a lot of people are curious about what happened at Big Blue on July 14th, they can make a mistake.
How do you respond to the Cincinnati case, the Seventh Circuit, where Judge Posner takes a very broad view, says, well, listen, citizens of this country pay for the courts, and public has an interest in what goes on in all stages of a judicial proceeding.
Right. You're talking about Citizens First versus
right.
Cincinnati Insurance?
Seventh Circuit.
Sure. That, of course, is in the context of materials being filed with the court under seal. And what was happening there is parties wanted to file records with the court for the court's use in the adjudicative process and wanted those materials to be sealed. And it's against that backdrop that those statements are made. Again, we're implicating the activities of the judge, the activities of the court system. But that's not what deposition transcripts are. Those are individual lawyers, in this case, in a private case, fighting about what occurred on July 14th. The court isn't there. The court isn't exercising its adjudicative authority. So Citizens First is not
if it's a private case, but it's brought to public court under laws passed by the public legislature.
Absolutely right. And so does this court. It's supported by public funds. And this court, the conference that you'll have after this hearing and where you decide how the case is decided isn't a matter that's open for all sorts of good reasons and tradition. Likewise, deposition transcripts, for a lot of good reasons that we've talked about, are not, there is no right of public access that has been recognized. So simply say, ultimately, there's public dollars behind it, doesn't answer the question, or I can come back and attend your conference, which of course I can.
Can I ask one other question?
Yes.
Judge Amato issued a gag order. It's my understanding from what Mr. Bush said that some of the attorneys interpreted that gag order as applying to all kinds of depositions beyond five. Mr. Bush said he went to court to clarify the gag order. How could he do that if he didn't intervene? Or did he have no right to
maybe, you know,
that?
Maybe he didn't, in that the gag order apply to what the parties could or couldn't do, what materials they could or couldn't disseminate. And if, in fact, they wanted to disseminate materials to the press and just didn't want to appear that they did, they could have asked the judge to clarify the scope of the order. I wasn't at the deposition. I didn't think there was any significant confusion about what Judge Amato had done on the gag order because it came up in the context of a discrete issue having to do with invocation of Fifth Amendment rights. So it wasn't any kind of a broad gag order. So I'm not sure where the confusion came from. But again, that would control the party's right to disseminate, not the Journal Sentinel.
Are you arguing that the Journal Sentinel had no right to seek a clarification of the gag order?
They had no protectable legal interest with respect to the party's right to disseminate materials. Party felt aggrieved by the inability to disseminate what Seattle Times teaches is that party has the right to challenge it. And Seattle Times, of course, was a litigant itself. So again, Judge Amato just blew right past the 80309 interest. And it's difficult because of the semantics. We're saying, well, I'm interested in the case. Well, of course you are. And curious, probably, I don't mean to demean it. It's an understandable, it's a proper interest. But it's not a builder interest. It's not an Armada interest. It's not an Edson interest. All those decisions point to specific statutes and say, in Armada, there was a half a page of statutes. Look at the privacy rights that you have the right, the protectable legal interest to protect. In Edson Builder was, look at the statute that says this is a public record. This is after the case is over. You have a right to protected by that statute. This is something created out of thin air and contrary to centuries of tradition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Thank you, Mr. Bush. That ends our hearing on this matter, and we adjourn for the day.